Outfar Press presents a talk by Father Roy Bourgeois, leader of the School of the Americas Watch. Father Bourgeois describes his evolution from soldier in Vietnam to missionary in Bolivia to the leading proponent for shutting down the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. Father Roy is introduced by Eric Dale and preceded by Lisa Faulkner Barnes, an activist and photojournalist recently returned from Haiti. Father Bourgeois and Lisa spoke to an audience in Willits, California on March 5th.
First, we'll be hearing from Lisa Faulkner Barnes, who is just back recently from a delegation to Haiti. She was with a delegation that went there to celebrate the anniversary of the coup, to recognize the anniversary of the coup. It was her second trip to Haiti. And she went there just after serving 3 months in prison for her actions at the School of the Americas. And I believe that was in last November's actions, or was that further back? Okay, you're out of jail in July. Okay, she'll fill you in on the details of that. She also has recently had an article published on Common Dreams, and we'll have an email that you can get in touch with her up here, I think, at the table will be afterwards, rather than me try to get everybody penning that. She's a mother of five. She's a graduate student at Sacramento State, and we're very pleased that she'll be joining us. And she will then introduce Father Roy, but I would like to say a few words just that you have an idea who he is. You probably know, and if you don't, he was the founder, among those who founded the School of America's Watch, the SOA Watch, in 1990. Prior to that, he served for 4 years in the military, the United States military. He then joined the Maryknoll Missionary Order, and he served for 5 years in Bolivia. And it was during his last year, his fifth year in Bolivia, that he was arrested and expelled from the country there. The SOA Watch, their mission, their goal is to close the School of the Americas and to change the U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. I think that's probably enough for me there, but Lisa, please join us. Let's give them a great welcome here.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you, too, for that spiritual uplift. It's been an incredible last couple weeks. And this is the end of our tour, and returning from this tour straight from Haiti, that was just lovely. It called to mind for me one of the reasons that I came into peace work, and I'd like to share that with you. In 1992, I had the opportunity to spend a month in Egypt and the Holy Land, and it was there that I fell in love with the idea of being able to serve people who had no voice. During that time, I spent a lot of time in little villages. It was an archaeological expedition as well as a spiritual journey. And there was one little girl that was meaningful to me. I thought I'd share her just a little bit with you. Her name was Nora. She tried to give me her little sister. We'd been there for about a week, and we'd grown quite fond of each other. I learned how to say a few words in Arabic. I'd say, "Intafi madrasa? Do you go to school?" And, you know, they'd come up and they'd ask back sheesh, and I'd change the subject, you know, because we want to keep these kids in school, not making a lot of money on the street. So she taught me some games, and I taught her some songs, and we tried to figure out a way to get her father some shoes. And like I said, she tried to give me her little sister the day we were pulling away. And as she was standing on the dock and she was waving to me, she said, "Remember Nora, remember Nora." And I just was reminded of Nora as you were singing. And I think of her often. In Haiti, there were many such Noras. As the people there are mourning the loss of their beloved president, duly elected by 92% of the vote 1 year ago, this weekend, we were there to help them have a peaceful demonstration and calling for the restoration of their president, as well as other elected leaders, one of which we stood in front of to try to keep safe during the demonstration. We met before the demo with UN officers and then stood in the most obvious place we could, in front of the most at-risk politician. And indeed, our portion of the demo up in Capetian went relatively well, although the demos all over the country ended up breaking in riots. No one was killed in ours. We just had minor injuries. And toward the end, down in the southern portion near Port-au-Prince, they weren't so lucky, as the police to disperse the crowd chose rather than pepper spray, as we got to experience. They just opened fire, and five lay in the street. And my good friend was Bill Quigley, my lawyer from School of the Americas Watch, was witness to that and documented that. And I appreciate his efforts, and I can't wait to find out if he's home safe. I went to Haiti as a full circle of my commitment to School of the Americas Watch, in that I felt as though seeing these people was looking into the eyes of the folks that I went to prison for. I would never have done that had it not been for Father Roy Bourgeois, who made me aware for the first time that this school exists and shouldn't, by the way, exist. There are some trained in Haiti that were trained at Fort Benning, not at the school, but at Fort Benning. And many there feel as though that's a satellite. And it definitely is an extension of the imperialism that we're all working toward bringing to light. You know, Aristotle said that we are what we continually do. And this man continually serves peace. Emerson said of men, and I believe he meant of women also, that if peace is to be maintained, it must be by brave men who have risen to the same height as the hero, who are willing to take their life in their hand and stake it at any instant for their principle. Certainly, this is what Father Roy Bourgeois has done. He is our very own potential Nobel Peace Prize nominee, and please join me in welcoming him, my hero.
Thank you so much, Lisa, and thank you really for being here this evening. It's a blessing for us to be with you. The last few days, we've been jumping around this beautiful part of the country, in the redwoods, out on the coast today. It's been deeply spiritual, really. Tonight, we're going to talk about an issue that really, it's about suffering. It's about causing suffering to others. It's about hunger, oppression, exploitation of sisters and brothers in Latin America. And I do believe what better place to talk about this than in our places of worship, where we gather as people of faith, people of goodwill, to worship a loving God, a very caring God who wants us to live as brothers and sisters, invited around the same table as equals, all called to be in that circle. I do believe that we are called to be peacemakers, to put it very simply, that we are to walk in solidarity with others in their struggle for justice and liberation. It took me a long time to get on that road to peace. Coming out of a small town in Louisiana, I grew up, I guess what you'd call a Sunday Catholic, a very loving family, hardworking folks. We were cut off in our little town. We did not talk about peace and justice. We didn't critique our country's foreign policy. I went out and went to the state university, got a degree in geology, hoping to get wealthy in the oil fields of South America. When I got out of college, Vietnam was on. It was easy for me to become a naval officer. Felt it was my responsibility to serve my country. And really, it was also my ticket out of Louisiana. I loved the sea. I was out traveling quite a bit aboard ship. Went to a NATO station in Europe for a year. And then volunteered for shore duty in Vietnam when our leader said we had to go there to stop the spread of communism. They said our cause was noble. We were going to be the liberators, the same language that we're using today toward Iraq. Well, many of us were changed in Vietnam and here at home because of the war, because of the violence, suffering, and death. People, what I've and many have discovered, of course, we can't go about this business of killing without it affecting us and our souls very deeply. We begin to question, and that's what I started to do for the very first time in Vietnam, was to question things, look deeper. And losing friends there, wounded there, I was forced to look at my faith more seriously. I began to realize how short life is and how fragile we all are, really. I've come to believe, too, that there is this wonderful, mysterious, divine grace at work in our lives. A very caring, loving God, trying to get our attention, trying to help us to become more human, more compassionate, more loving, less violent. And I was led to this missionary near our base, caring for about 300 children at this orphanage. My buddies and I would go do some volunteer work to help out the old missionary. And I remember when I was at the orphanage, I was sort of rediscovering, recapturing some of that hope and joy that I lost when I arrived in Vietnam. I think hope and joy are just so essential to our faith, to what it means to be a human being. When we lose it, it seems like we stop being human. That's not God's divine plan for us. My year was coming to an end. I talked to an army chaplain about missionary work, trying to do what I saw this missionary doing, healing, peacemaking. He was doing what Jesus did. This army chaplain recommended the Marino community, and I said, Mary who? I had never heard of them. He said they're working in 28 countries around the world, serving the poor. He also said they were the Marines of the Catholic Church. And that sounded good. So I came home and entered the Marino community after visiting, of course, my family in Louisiana, and just so grateful and happy to be reunited with them. And after these comfortable years in seminaries out east, I was finally ordained a Catholic priest and assigned to our work in Bolivia. And the next 5 years, I lived and worked in this barrio, which became my home. The first year, I wondered whether I could survive there. I was hit with typhoid fever, struggled with the language. But I have to tell you, the people I went there to serve, they became my teachers, my healers. That's the way it works when we put our feet in another culture. We have so much to learn. Most of the people of Bolivia and throughout the developing world, as we know, struggle for survival. They see their children die before their time. They don't have schools, hospitals. They don't receive a living wage for their labor. Bolivia was under a brutal dictator, General Hugo Banzer, who had come into power through a violent coup. Throughout the country were the men with the guns, the bullies, defending that system, really, that kept the rich rich and the poor poor. the big corporations were coming in, the multinationals that we read a lot about today. They come into these countries where there are huge profits to be made from the cheap labor and those vast resources. In Latin America, they are seen as the new conquistadors. I was introduced in Bolivia to a new theology that gives hope to the poor. For many, many years, the poor were taught a cruel theology, a very colonial theology, that taught them to accept their suffering, their lot in life, as God's will. To be silent, to look forward to the next life. And to be honest, this was the theology that I was weaned on in the Deep South and still very alive in many churches and faith communities today. Of course, the rich embraced that theology. It kept the status quo going. It kept those in power, those with the wealth, continuing in that situation. And it really condemned the poor to a life of misery with no hope. But something's happening today, and it started years ago. They say it began in Medellin, Colombia in the 70s when the U.S. Catholic bishops came together and reported that in their countries there were the comunidades de base, the base communities that were flourishing. These were the people, the poorest of the poor, gathering in their homes at night with candlelight, dirt floor. They gather to read the scriptures, many for the first time. And they come to discover, as we do when we read the scriptures, a very loving and compassionate God. We come to discover our Creator, who has given to our country and every country more than enough blessings and resources for everyone to live comfortably. But as we know, what was put here by our Creator for all to share and to be responsible stewards of have ended up in the hands of a small elite. Greed has set in, selfishness, militarism, foreign policy, the multinationals have come in. Well, what's going on is not complicated. The poor coming now to understand and see God really for the first time, their true God. They're becoming empowered by their faith. And Paul says that this way, if our faith is not empowering us, para que sirve? For what does it serve? It's dead and we are dead. And so the poor, when we become empowered in our faith, of course, we are agents of change. We cannot go back to the person we used to be. And what's going on in Latin America and throughout the developing world, the poor are calling for justice and for peace. In Latin America, they are saying, basta. We're not going to sit back and endure our suffering. They know the causes, the root causes, the reasons for their suffering. And they are about changing that reality. Now, when they speak out for justice, for land reform, for schools and hospitals, the men with the guns are there to silence them. Many are forced to leave the country. Many are killed. Many are imprisoned. In my fifth year, I was arrested, and I was forced out of the country. I couldn't return. It was a hard time, a very lonely time. I didn't really know what to do, where to go. I went to Almerno headquarters in New York for a while, studied, took a couple of courses at the new school in New York City. And then my attention turned to El Salvador with a lot of friends. It was a country far worse than the one I came from. In El Salvador, 14 families ended up with 60% of the land. It was in this country that Archbishop Oscar Romero was assassinated for his defense of the poor. It was here also where four churchwomen from our country who went to El Salvador at the invitation of Bishop Romero were stopped one day by the military. They were raped and they were killed. Two of them were friends of the Marino sisters, Maura Clark and Ida Ford. With them was Sister Dorothy Kazel from Cleveland, an Ursuline nun, and lay missionary Jean Donovan from Cleveland. When that happened, it shook us. It brought El Salvador closer to home. It really forced many of us to go to El Salvador now and try to find out what was going on. We, of course, found what they found. We found really a country whose people were being killed, a government at war with its people. I've never seen anything quite like El Salvador. I was more frightened there than in Vietnam or in Bolivia. I have never seen such powerless people before. Their loved ones would be picked up at night. The knock would come on the door. It's the death squads. They're picking up the campesinos, university students, human rights advocates, those who dare to come together in the base communities to read the scriptures. They were the leaders in the comunidad de base. And there was a list. They would just be picked up at night, never to be seen again. Los desaparecidos. The loved ones couldn't do anything. If they went to the police station, to the military, they would be arrested and killed. They couldn't go to an attorney. They had no place to go. I came home, as many did, and could not keep quiet. I had to speak out in colleges and churches and peace groups. And then, in the midst of a big speaking tour, I read in the New York Times that 525 soldiers had just arrived at Fort Benning, Georgia, from El Salvador to start training now on U.S. soil. I felt I had to cancel a lot of these speaking engagements and go to Fort Benning. And I went there with a couple of friends, and we rented this house. We called it Casa Romero. And we started to organize in the area and gave talks at churches and some colleges. And then what we did was three of us decided to stop talking to our own people and take the message to the Salvadoran soldiers who were being trained on Fort Benning and the art of killing. Linda Ventimiglia and our little group of three had trained at Fort Benning. She was now in the Army Reserves. Larry Rosebaum had just come back from his work in Brazil as an oblate priest, and I. We went down to this Army surplus place, got ourselves some Army uniforms at Ranger Joe's. And a few nights later, we entered Fort Benning. It was at night, and we were dressed as these high-ranking Army officers. And we had with us this tape player boombox, and it was the last sermon of Bishop Romero that he gave in the cathedral the day before he was killed, where he made his special plea to the men in the military to stop the killing, to lay down their weapons. He also said to them, disobey your superior officers telling you to kill your fellow campesinos, your brothers and sisters of El Salvador, and obey a higher law, the law of God that says, thou shall not kill. Bishop Romero was causing the government of El Salvador lots of problems. Thousands and thousands would listen to him on his weekly radio station, where he would give the names of those disappeared, those killed. And in his masses at the cathedral each Sunday, he would call on the military to stop the killing. He knew that death was close. He had received many death threats. But he said that, you know, that I can't leave the country as his friends wanted him to do. I've got to stay here. They need me. I have a responsibility, he said. I have a voice. They don't. And so that moment came while saying Mass. He was killed by this assassin. Martyrs, you know, they stretch us. They give us courage that we normally wouldn't have. And that's what happened to us that evening. It was really Bishop Romero that inspired us to do what we did. And I think he was with us in a special way that night because we were scared. We didn't think maybe we would get very far in our mission. But we were able to penetrate this high security area way out in the woods, went right near the barracks where the Salvadorans were housed, got saluted along the way. And with tree climbers, we scaled this tall pine tree, and we waited. And about 11 o'clock at night, when the lights all went out, we said, "Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother." And his voice boomed into the barracks, and it was like poking a beehive. They were pretty upset with us. We saw this, of course, as a very sacred moment. They didn't see it that way. They came out with their guns and dogs and lights and spotted us in the tree and threatened to shoot us down if we didn't come down. And, of course, it was time to come down. But left the boom box up there last night. We were brought to the county jail and then to trial for this judge who we got to know later during the years as Maximum Bob. He didn't like protesters. Sent civil rights leaders in the South to jail. And he sent us to prison for a year and a half. And it was hard, lonely. Actually, going to prison was easy compared to dealing with my mother. Really, when we go to prison for these, for our faith, really, when we do actions like this, it's hard for others to understand. It's not easy. We have all dealt with this in our movement, over 200 of us, dealing with loved ones. The dilemma, of course, is we go through life, all of us, with different experiences that change us, and we meet people along the way who change us. And then you put that in the context of our faith in our God calling us and how we respond. It takes us perhaps in different directions. And in order to be faithful, in order to hold on to our integrity, in order to be able to sleep at night, we got to do certain things. To be free, to hold on to that inner peace, to keep our prayer life alive. But when we do these things, it causes problems with parents and siblings and friends. They don't understand that experience. And what's most important, of course, is being true to our own experience. And there are no shortcuts. We have to try to explain that to others. And I must say, though, it's been the experience of so many of our people who have gone to prison. The visits in prison, the long letters from prison, have brought us much closer together, where this love and support gets stronger. And it's not that they have to somehow join us in our cause. No, it's unconditional. What I've learned with my own family, true, they've come down, you know, now to our November protest, and not overnight, but in time. But and that's wonderful. But if it weren't that way, that's okay too. We got in out of prison in good shape. It was a good long spiritual retreat. You got time to read those books you don't have time for on the outside. You don't have those phone calls or that computer to keep you too busy. And we went back to work, but we couldn't stop the military aid. Tens of thousands tried to stop it. It increased, got up to $1 million a day, all from our tax money. The bloodshed continued. November the 16th, 1989, another massacre. This time they went after the Jesuits, a well-known order. They are better known as probably educators. In the U.S., they run 28 universities and many high schools. University of San Francisco, Loyola Marymount, Georgetown, Boston College. They were very upset with the Jesuits, as they were with Bishop Romero. They were identifying the idols, the false gods. They called it by its right name, worshiping the gods of wealth and power. The Jesuits, they went a step further. They began, well, like Bishop Romero, to also identify those who were worshiping the idols, those in the military and those institutions. And that got them in big trouble. And so they enter their campus after midnight, drag these six Jesuits out of their rooms, and with them was Elva, a young mother, their co-worker, and her 15-year-old daughter, Selena. And they were killed at close range, each of them shot, massacred. And this made the front pages of our newspapers all over the country, and it really angered many of our members of Congress who had been supporting all that military aid to the government of El Salvador. They sent a congressional task force to investigate, and they came back, these congresspeople, reporting that those responsible were trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. When I and many of us read that report, it got a lot of coverage. We felt it was important to go back to Fort Benning and investigate that school. I called my headquarters in New York. I was now working out of our Marino Peace and Justice Center in Minneapolis. I was there for 3 years. I loved that part of the country, very beautiful, like California. But it was time to break camp and head back to Fort Benning. And of course, I got that blessing. Didn't have to convince my community about the need to investigate this. We work in Latin America and know firsthand the brutality of the military toward the poor. When I got to Fort Benning, right outside of its main gate, there was a little apartment complex. A soldier had just been transferred, ran $175 a month, which is a lot better than here. Mm-hmm. And this became our SOA watch. We didn't have a movement back then or a vision of starting anything big. I called friends and got the place fixed up, and they started coming into town. Charlie Litke arrived from the Bay Area, a Vietnam veteran, recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Kathy Kelly, some of you may know, came from Chicago, who went on to co-found Voices in the Wilderness, doing a lot of important work on Iraq. A Jesuit came in, a couple of Dominican priests, three Salvadorans who had to flee their country with death threats. Our very first action was a fast, a very serious fast, water only. And we planned this fast actually at a nice restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it sounded good at the time. We were talking about what we were going to do and came up with this idea of a fast. And so actually a couple days later, we began the fast, camping out at the main gate of Fort Benning, taking it a day at a time. And it was hard. Our bodies grew weak. But the spirit remained strong. Every day from 5 to 6, we would have a time for prayer and reflection. And people, the local paper started to cover the fast, especially into the second week when we started to hurt. And people would come to be with us, 50, 100, 150 people. They'd bring their music, their poetry, their prayer. It was uplifting. Soldiers sometimes would come seek us out 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock, like Nicodemus, afraid to be seen. In the daylight. Wanted to talk with especially Charlie Litke, the Medal of Honor recipient, about why he's here. What would you believe in so deeply that you would, you know, not eat? And a lot of hearts were moved during those 35 days of our fast, including our own, especially our own. When we ended our fast, oh, I must say, food never tasted so good. It was wonderful. Your taste buds become so sensitive. And of course, for the first week, you have to take it really easy. Be very gentle on your stomach, just with broth and veggies. And then we had to get to work and do research. We knew so little about the issue. And through the Freedom of Information Act and helped along by members of Congress, we started to piece together a history of the School of the Americas. And our country was unknown, and Latin America well known as the School of Assassins. We learned it began in Panama way back in 1946, all done through a charter in Congress financed by the taxpayers to bring stability to Latin America. Something went wrong. Perhaps it was well-intentioned. It became known as a school of assassins, as a school for dictators. Some of the best-known graduates, Manuel Noriega from Panama, this general sitting in a federal prison in Miami doing 25 years for drug running. It hurt when we learned that General Hugo Banza was not only a graduate, but this thug from Bolivia was inducted into the school's Hall of Fame, where his photograph was on the wall with some 20 other generals presented as these model soldiers. The sword of General Augusto Pinochet was hanging on the wall, not a graduate, but given to the school, with a very personal letter to the commandant about the good work the school was doing. Death squad leaders went through here. The school every year took in about 1,000 soldiers from 18 countries to train them in commando operations, psychological warfare, counterinsurgency. When we arrived on the scene, they had trained over 55,000 over the years. It was serious because these soldiers returned to their home countries and really caused untold suffering and death to their people. And we learned about this, really, how serious it was when the United Nations Truth Commission report on El Salvador was released and got a lot of front-page coverage. The UN report documented that those who killed Bishop Romero trained here. Those who raped and killed the churchwoman were graduates. Those who killed the Jesuits and the two women of the 19 of them graduates. And there was El Masote, where over 800 were killed in this remote village, including over 100 children under the age of 10. Of the 12 responsible, 10 of them graduates. And the list went on and on. Now, as word, what we would do is take this documentation and started to set up a website. We began to go around the country to speak, to spread the word, to shout up from the rooftops, to speak in churches, in classes, peace groups, anyone who would listen to us, little groups, big groups, doing everything we can to call attention to this issue, this school down in Georgia. And then something started to happen. A movement began to take root and blossom. Grace, of course, was at work. That first November, first we felt it was important to gather at the main gate in November to simply keep alive the memory of the victims. That first November, 10 of us gathered. That was our little group from the FAST. The next November, 100 came, and then 500 the next year, 1,000. Well, this last November, over 16,000 came. And it was a great joy to see that. When we gather, it's a celebration of hope. I want to know, too, I know I've met this gentleman who has been down with us for a couple of, who has been down with us over the years. Could you just stand? I would like for you to just, I want to acknowledge your presence. If those who have been with us in the past. You're from the, your name, I'm sorry?
From here.
Yes.
Richard Hinker.
They all know you, I'm sure. Okay, good. Well, they'll meet you after if they don't. about half of the 16,000 were college students. We had a lot of military veterans with us. who see this issue as bringing shame to our country. We had a lot of nuns who joined our movement in the very early days. A lot of parents with their children. We also had a lot of senior citizens, and we're privileged to have with us tonight the president of a group called Grandmothers for Peace, who are always with us from the early days. This gathering, but I want to also introduce Lorraine Krofcek. Could you please stand? I want them to see you. The president of Grandmothers for Peace. We also would have some literature to take home later. That weekend is filled with some wonderful speakers coming in from Latin America, from the U.S. We have a lot of good musicians. Pete Seeger has been with us for a few times, Amy Ray of the Indigo Girls, and many speakers and musicians. The puppeteers have become a big part of our movement. A lot of the youth arrive early to build up our movement. And they add so much joy to the movement, the puppet. We call them the puppetistas, the puppeteers. And then on Sunday, it's more solemn. We have our memorial service. And what it's become a tradition in our movement is this solemn funeral procession. We begin the march. We carry these makeshift coffins. Thousands bring a cross bearing the name of the victim and their ages, many of them children. They have their photographs. And we process eight abreast down the boulevard, and we get to the main gate of Fort Benning. The gates are locked. It's a big chain link fence topped with barbed wire with signs that say no trespassing. But when we get to the sign, we turn it into something very sacred, this memorial wall. We take our religious symbols, the photographs of the victims, and we put them on that fence. You can't see the other side. Some of our veterans, like Laura Slattery, West Point graduate from the Bay Area, 2 years ago, returned her uniform, along with other veterans. Some return their medals. Lots going on there. Many, many talk about how deeply spiritual it is, that experience. The procession, how when we call out presente after the person's name, we touch on the sacred here. And what happens, of course, when we touch on the sacred, we weep, many weep. I can only say that we're not going away. It has also become a tradition when we gather for some to feel called in the context of their faith and knowledge to go over that fence or around the fence. Most cannot do that, of course. Of the 16,000 this last November, we had, 13 of our people who did that. Now, over the years, over 200 of our people have gone off to prison for the acts of civil disobedience. There have been students, nuns, senior citizens, like Sister Dorothy Hennessy, the 88-year-old nun from Dubuque, Iowa. We've had grandparents, parents, Lisa, mother of five sons. When they send us to prison, it energizes the movement. They cannot silence us. We speak from prison. The truth cannot be silenced. And it simply brings more people the next November. Let me say that we're going to be back at the main gate in November. It's the weekend before Thanksgiving. It would be wonderful, of course, and a great blessing to our movement if you can be with us. We've met some wonderful people nearby. Garberville, the Veterans for Peace, are coming back in their bus. I know in Fort Bragg, we had a huge crowd there last night. Lots of people said they're coming for the first time. They're looking at a bus. We get some group rates on airfares. It's not that expensive. But check your calendar, think about it, discern. If you cannot be down with us the weekend before Thanksgiving at the main gate of Fort Benning, we can do something locally here in the church. We've got some wonderful resources, videos that can be shown, have a prayer gathering. Also, we have a bill in Congress that was formerly H.R. 1258, but next week it's going to be a new bill with a new number. This bill is an important one. It calls for the closing of the school. It will take the $20 million and cut it off, which will essentially shut it down. And your letters to your members of Congress are very important. And in that letter, it would be important, perhaps many of our people write this in their letters or mention this in the phone calls, to say to that member of Congress, we don't want you using our money this way. We want you to direct that $20 million into schools for our children and to programs that are going to help people. We move on. There's a lot to do. We need your voices. I'm simply here to offer you an invitation to be a part of this wonderful grassroots movement rooted in nonviolence, connected in solidarity with the suffering poor of Latin America. But this invitation really does not come from me. It comes from sisters and brothers in Latin America who are the victims of this school and our country's foreign policy. Together we can shut it down. We have no doubt about that. It's going to happen. It could possibly happen this year or next year. Bishop Oscar Romero, before he was assassinated, said that said it this way: let those who have a voice speak for the voiceless. We have a voice, and I just hope and pray that each of us, in our own way, as best we can speak clearly and act boldly at this time. Thank you.
You have been listening to a talk by Father Roy Bourgeois and Lisa Faulkner Barnes. To find out more about Father Roy and the School of the America Watch, please visit their website at www.soaw.org or call 202-234-3440. Lisa has a current article on commondreams.org, and her photography may be seen at www.applegallery.com. That's spelled applegallery.com. This recording is a production of outfarpress.com, where you can listen globally to the weekly 30-minute radio show, The Shortwave Report. This program was produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. For outfarpress.com, I'm Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.